in the Friday Forum series, and we have been following the series along this spring. This is a series of noontime talks. They happen at noon on Friday at the University Y. It's jointly sponsored by the University YMCA, the McKinley Foundation, the Episcopal Church Foundation, and the Wesley Foundation. And the overall theme for the series this spring is responding to racism. And today we'll be speaking with Professor Barry Mailer, who is a professor in the Department of Humanities at Ferris State University, which is in Big Rapids, Michigan. We'll be talking about academic racism and the growing eugenics movement. And as we talk with Professor Mailer, of course, you are welcome to call in. All you need to do is pick up the telephone and call. You'd like to participate in our program. The local number here to call is 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Barry Mailer may be familiar to some of you here on this campus, as he did his PhD here. He really is an authority on the topic of racism and has done a lot of research and writing, and now has rather been widely interviewed, not only this on this topic of the eugenics movement, academic racism, but also on extreme right political groups, on the Ku Klux Klan, on the neo-Nazis. Also, I think on this program some time ago, he spoke with us about Lyndon LaRouche and his people. And so this is the kind of area that he has devoted a great deal of time and energy to. And again, as we talk, perhaps you'll have questions. We would welcome those. It's good to see you again.
Well, it's great to be back here. It's great to be back here. As you say, you know, I think this is about the fifth or sixth time I've been in the studio with you. So it's really nice to be home.
Perhaps for people who aren't quite certain what the eugenics movement is all about, it would be good to start by giving us a definition.
That's right, a real thumbnail. The eugenics movement is the movement to improve the human species by selective breeding, by encouraging the reproduction of the superior humans and by discouraging the reproduction of inferior human beings. The movement got started around the turn of the century, and the United States was the world leader of the eugenics movement until Adolf Hitler came along. Some of the aspects of it were sterilization programs for people who were regarded as feeble-minded or had biological tendencies to criminal behavior, etc. And we actually passed in this country some 30-odd state sterilization laws, and in 1927 the Supreme Court ruled that sterilization, eugenic forced sterilization was legal in the United States. Immigration restriction was a eugenic policy, and encouraging the breeding of the superior elements in the country. You could do that, for example, by tax incentives. Instead of taxing the wealthy — superior and wealthy were synonymous terms, basically — so instead of taxing the wealthy to support the poor, what you want to do is tax the poor to support the wealthy. You don't want to discourage those who are doing well in society from having large families. In Europe, under Adolf Hitler, the eugenics program finally produced its ultimate flowering in breeding farms and death camps. So the first wave of the eugenics movement basically produced sterilization programs, breeding farms, and death camps. After World War II, the whole movement was really buried under the bones and ashes of its millions of victims. And in the last few decades, we've seen a resurgence, a reemergence of this movement.
And it seems to have acquired, or perhaps it always has, but it seems now to have acquired a stamp, what one might say is a stamp of academic legitimacy, at least in the sense that there are people who seem to have the right kind of credentials, who are working in academic surroundings, who publish their papers in what seem to be the appropriate kind of journals and speak to the appropriate kind of meetings, that are advancing these kinds of theories.
It's an interesting question, because I'm looking at the history of the eugenics movement, and in all the literature to date, in all the monographs that have been written on the eugenics movement, What you find is that the scholars say that the old style eugenics, the old style of eugenics that led to sterilization, breeding farms, and death camps, that eugenics died after World War II, and what you had was a wholly different form of eugenics, a eugenics that was much more humanitarian, medical genetics, for example, genetic counseling, these things that were much less concerned about in terms of racist implications and social policy implications. And what I found is that if you take a look at the post-war period, you find that the old-style eugenics continued right along, and you had the same kinds of people. For example, in 1954, the eugenics movement in the United States launched a massive assault on Brown v. Board of Education and school disintegration. And it was led by Henry Garrett, who was the chairman of the Department of Psychology at Columbia University, president of the American Psychological Association, one of the foremost psychologists in the United States. There was nothing wrong with the man's credentials. What's interesting is nobody paid attention to him. Because in 1954, the Liberal Democratic Coalition was in ascendancy, and basically liberal scholars who were writing the history of the eugenics movement, who were writing the history of the civil rights movement, basically ignored these people. Because regardless of Henry Garrett's credentials, he could not gain the ear of the broader public. And what was interesting to see is that the liberal scholars felt that the old eugenics died because nobody was looking at it. In other words, if you didn't see it, it didn't exist. What has happened more recently is that these same scholars in the post-war period were producing students. And these students went off to perfectly legitimate academic positions. And now these students are publishing and writing and arguing and thinking. What really has happened is not that the old eugenics movement has changed or that the people are in new positions or publishing in new places, but the political center of gravity in the West itself has moved significantly to the right since the Reagan Revolution, since Margaret Thatcher. And as a result, these ideas are coming to the fore. People are now seeing that they exist because they are politically useful, and political organizations, institutions are paying attention to them. And I think that's what's happening, rather than any change in the quality of the people who are arguing eugenics.
Uh-huh. Does it seem that these arguments are finding they are of greater appeal than they were, or are they finding receptive audience?
A receptive audience and new appeal. It was interesting. Last year, when J. Philip Rushton went to the American Association for the Advancement of Science meetings, for those who are unaware, last year in February, full professor of psychology at the University of Western Ontario, at that time little known, but he had an impressive publication history. I have a 15 or 16-page bibliography of his work and publishing in academic journals throughout the world, very fine journals. He also was a Simon Guggenheim Fellow, which is America's most prestigious academic fellowship, or one of the most prestigious, certainly. He went to the AAAS meeting last year to present a paper on racial differences in character traits. Across the board, he had 60 different character measures. So it wasn't just focused on intelligence, but it was focused on all kinds of character traits. And he basically divided the three races, blacks, whites, and Asians. And he said that the difference between these three groups is an evolutionary one, that the blacks are the most primitive, and that as the human species moved into Europe, into colder climes, the human species developed into a higher race, and then as the human species moved even further into Asia, Mongolia, where it was extremely cold, the species developed even higher. So he said that the basic difference between blacks and Orientals, for example, is that the Orientals have large brains and small genitals, and the blacks have small brains and large genitals, and the whites are in between. There are 700 reporters at the AAAS, and when he presented these findings, the reporters hit the ceiling. It was just, there was this media assault on the man, and there were calls for his dismissal at Western Ontario. The premier of Western Ontario called his ideas and his thinking despicable. It was, there's just this outrage. And I began getting phone calls about to discuss the history of his ideas, and I told people, called me, Phil Rushton did not fall from the sky. Phil Rushton is a John Simon Guggenheim fellow who has been publishing these ideas for the last 5 years. The only reason that people have taken notes suddenly is because he presented these ideas to reporters, not to academics. And I think that since last year, the whole debate has really opened up, and a number of scholars now are beginning to gain prominence as a result of that whole incident. I mean, a number of eugenic scholars, eugenic advocates.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess that just to remind you, if you've just tuned in and within the last 5 or 10 minutes, our guest is Barry Mailer. He is a professor in the Department of Humanities at Ferris State University, which is located in Michigan, in Big Rapids, Michigan. We're talking this morning about academic racism and the growing eugenics movement. Barry Mailer is here to speak at the Friday Forum today at noontime. So if you are here in and around Champaign-Urbana, you will have further opportunities to hear from him. But one opportunity you will have here this morning is if you have questions or comments you'd like to direct the conversation in a particular way, you can do that by calling and talking with us, 333-WILL or 9455. Toll free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-WILL. How have the institutions where these academics reside responded to this? And did they, was it their hope that as long as no one really knew what these people were doing, or their work wasn't widely read and didn't get a lot of attention, that they really wouldn't have to bother with it?
Well, it's for an administrator. For example, in 1969, Arthur Jensen published his historic article in the Harvard Educational Review on why Head Start programs don't work. I was working in Head Start at the time, and we had children who were coming to us in the morning, and we were feeding them breakfast. We were giving them a breakfast that they wouldn't have at home. And I read Arthur Jensen's article, and he was basically, my interpretation was, he was saying, don't bother feeding them breakfast because it's not going to increase their IQ. The article made a sensation. Since then, Arthur Jensen has received, I think, close to $1 million in funds from the Pioneer Fund. His university has received a cut of that money. And university administrators, money talks. J. Philip Rushton has gotten somewhere a couple of $100,000 from the Pioneer Fund. So that there are funding agencies who are willing to support these people. Then there's also the publicity, which can be, is a two-edged sword. The University of Western Ontario, for example, came to Rushton's defense, and they said, this is a question of academic freedom. The man has a right to say, to espouse his theories. And in fact, I was asked my opinion, and I said to it was a Canadian Educational Association that was doing an investigation, and I said, you don't destroy an idea by cutting off the head of the person who has the idea. You've got to confront the issues. And I didn't think that firing Rushton was going to be useful. On the other hand, various institutions have responded differently. The University of London last year, when they discovered that Hans Eysenck was receiving money from the Pioneer Fund, which is the major source of funding for all of this research. The Pioneer Fund funds basically everyone who was doing research to show the intellectual inferiority of Negroes and this whole eugenic theory. They are the primary funding agency. The University of London froze the funds and initiated an investigation. The University of Delaware now, where there's again a Pioneer Fund scandal going on, has called for a major investigation. And so the question arises in terms of response of institutions is how to respond to should we or should we not take money from the Pioneer Fund. The students of the University of Delaware ran an editorial in which they said this is essentially dirty money. And the University of Delaware should not take this money. They should return what has been taken and disassociate themselves, because when you associate yourself with a eugenic institution, you lend credibility to the institution. As far as the individual scholars are concerned, I don't advocate throwing out people, you know, out of universities because of their attitudes, because they're, for example, because they're racist. The fact is that we have to understand it. If you want to fire every racist professor in America, you're not going to have any professors left. I mean, we are raised in a society in which that racism is pervasive. And one of the points that I want to make is we all need to have a little humility here in terms of our own attitudes. We try to divide people between the racist and the not racist. You know, my mother used to say, so-and-so doesn't have a racist bone in their body. I mean, it isn't true. I mean, we all have to learn. We really need to have some humility about this, and we need to try to distinguish between racism and the racist. The racist is a human being. Racism is a deplorable idea, and we need to confront it. In some cases, there was a fellow, I think his name was C.P. Ellis, who was a Ku Klux Klan member, a leader of the Ku Klux Klan, and got involved in a local community activity around the public school with a member of the leader of the black community, and the two of them, you know, they hated each other. But they had to work together, and he went through a metamorphosis, and he has he's become an opponent of Klan ideas. He was able to grow and change. And people like that are of enormous value to our society. And we have to learn from that. It doesn't have to be as dramatic as I was a member of the Ku Klux Klan and now, you know, I see the light. We all have to grow in that way. We all have to develop sensitivities, and we have our own prejudices. One of the things that I, you know, constantly tell audiences when I talk about the prejudices on American campuses, the most common prejudice on college campuses, as far as I can tell, is the belief in the intellectual inferiority of undergraduate students. That appears to me to be the most widespread prejudice. We believe these students, they can't read, they can't write, they're getting worse every generation, and it must be biological. I don't know, because they used to be a whole lot better in the old days.
When we were undergraduates.
When we were undergraduates, that's right.
Yeah. We have a caller here to talk with. Let's do that on our toll-free line. Good morning.
Hi. I've heard that Margaret Sanger was active in the eugenics movement. Do you know if she really was, and if she was, what did she do?
Yes, she really was. She really was corrupted by it. She started out working with Emma Goldman, doing work with tenement house people, immigrants, and very wonderful work. And Emma Goldman never compromised and refused. Emma Goldman was asked about eugenics, and she said, if we have to sterilize criminals, let's start with the big criminals. Let's sterilize Rockefeller and Carnegie. They're the ones who were, you know, are stealing the big money. What's the difference with the petty crooks? I mean, it takes a million of them to steal as much money as Rockefeller steals. So that's the kind of statement she would make. Whereas Margaret Sanger was approached by the Rockefeller Foundation, and they said, you know, we are interested in funding your work. We are concerned about birth control, and she began taking their money, and the birth control movement really gained credibility, she saw that in order to gain the funds of the leading agencies of the time, leading foundations of the time, one had to use these eugenic arguments. The idea was that birth control will limit the reproduction of these less intelligent, appropriate sectors of the society. And so she did get sucked into that, and she ended up, the birth control review began to espouse eugenic policy. So that's true.
Oh, thank you very much.
All right, thank you for the call. Other callers are welcome. You have questions for our guest, Barry Mailer, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I suppose whenever one gets to talk about these kinds of ideas, there may be a some disagreement about how much attention one should give them. And I suppose there will always be people who will argue that that somehow the way to deal with these people is by ignoring them, and that by talking about their ideas, somehow you are being an agent in spreading them. And I take it that you would not take that point of view. Your point of view would be that we ought to be doing what we can to shine lights into dark corners, because one never knows what's in those corners, and we ought to know.
Well, as I said, in 1954, these people were running around, and they were Henry Garrett, for example, was testifying in federal court, and he was giving papers and talking to people and saying that school integration won't work because Negro children are intellectually inferior to white children, and if you put them into the same class, you're only harming the poor kids. And he presented himself as an advocate for the black children. I mean, he was really concerned about what was going to happen to them when you put them in competition with white children who were biologically, intellectually superior. Henry Garrett was ignored. And in that environment, there was no problem with ignoring him because basically the dominant ideology of the time was a liberal democratic ideology. They can't be ignored anymore. The world is really changing. We're seeing major and dramatic changes in Eastern Europe, Soviet Union. Nationalisms are growing everywhere, and fascism is on the horizon everywhere. And these ideologies are the foundation for fascism, and at this point we have to speak up, and we have to now familiarize ourselves with the whole history of these intellectual movements.
Has this kind of thinking, do you believe, have had an impact on policy making?
Oh, absolutely. Our own Jerry Hirsch has done a marvelous job of documenting the use of Arthur Jensen's 1969 article, which he shows was brought right into the White House staff meetings and with Richard Nixon. And the question was, should we continue funding Head Start programs? And here's the evidence that they are not useful to fund. So these people, in fact, that's one of the major differences between the theories that are espoused by the skinhead movement. You know, your skinheads are on the streets, they're not in the White House, so they're not in policy-making positions, whereas professors are in policy-making positions. So these ideas then result in changes in policy. That's a major concern of mine for paying more attention. All of the monitoring agencies have shown that in the last decade there's been a dramatic increase in racism. And how do they show that? I mean, they count the number of swastikas and they count the number of skinhead groups. And my concern is that it's all right to count the number of swastikas, but we really need to understand that the problems are much larger than that.
Here's another caller again on our toll-free line. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
My question would reach into the area of sperm banks, like stockpiling the sperm of Nobel laureates and well-thought-of, well-respected physicists and the top intellectual giants, I suspect. Is that an aspect of your eugenics? I'll listen off the air. Thank you.
Sure. Okay. That's a very good question. I'm glad you asked it because it's a major aspect of the new eugenics. You have to realize that the old eugenics, the eugenics of the Hitler era and the pre-Hitler era, didn't have the biological technology to do very much. They talked about breeding better humans, but there wasn't much they could do. I mean, Hitler established breeding farms. He brought the girls in and he impregnated them with his, you know, SS elite, and he was going to breed superhumans. Whereas today we have a tremendous biological technology. The new eugenicists are extraordinarily excited about the idea that a new eugenics movement, imagine what Adolf Hitler could do if he had sperm banks and egg banks and recombinant DNA and genetic engineering and amniocentesis and all of these kinds of technologies. The new eugenics movement with these technologies offers a much brighter hope for breeding.